Hey, folks. Welcome to episode 2 of Frankly Speaking. And here we talk about stories of extraordinary people of the seacoast. And I am an absolute honor to have Steve Turner with us tonight. And I'm going to open this real quick with a side note. You and Sherry had come in for a visitation at Tasker Funeral Home. This idea of a podcast was up here in my head.
Yep.
And you were always first and foremost of one of the first three people I wanted to have if I ever were to do this, because the basis always was to highlight people in the seacoast, what I felt doing stuff over and above. You guys came in, I clammed up and kind of beefooted over to the other side of the building, because it's like, here is a guy that has, and we'll talk about the three things I look at, not the three things that I look at, but how I want this conversation to kind of go is your business life, your nonprofit life, and your ultra marathon life. And we'd also like to thank our other sponsor, Jeff Big Daddy Goss, owner of the Clipper Tavern at 75 Pleasant Street, Portsmouth, where you'll find the Mac Daddy, my personal favorite. Also, Jitto's Super Steak Sub Shop at 3131 Lafayette Road, where you'll find the steak, egg, and cheese sandwich as my personal favorite there also. And then the sweet spot, Cape Natick Country Club, where you're going to find the best coconut margarita on the planet. Thank you of our sponsors. I had nothing but an idea in my head. So it's like, I wasn't pursuing nothing. It was an idea. An opportunity came up, and that's where we're here. So if you know Steve's history, and some of it is with Turner Upholstery, we're going to talk about that. As a young 14-year-old kid, we're going to talk about the nonprofit, which is really just is absolutely phenomenal, to the ultra marathoning, and we'll get started. So with that, how does a 14-year-old kid become what you've done with Turner Upholstery at this point, which is a stellar reputation with high quality work, with people waiting to get into your shop?
Well, first off, thank you, Darryl, for having me. It's a pleasure, and it's an honor to be on this side. Seriously, I mean, everything in life, I say that, you know, everything, you know, Tom Brady was good, but it's the team behind him. So, like me, you talk about how much stuff I've done. Without the support system, I wouldn't be able to do anything. So, first off the bat, it is me that's done it, but without my support system, you know, Turner's Upholstery, you know, my wife, Bring Back the Trades, support, running, everything in life you can't do by yourself. So that's how I want to start first off the bat, because I like to praise everybody that helps me because it keeps me going. So that's how. Okay. But your question about how I got into upholstery?
Yeah, because it's not something, I mean, in very much too, in what you're trying to do with what you're doing with Bring Back the Trades is to recognizing those kids. It's a field that you don't see a lot of.
Yes.
Exactly. And if you do a job properly, it's going to probably last somebody, particularly in the custom cars that you do, the life of their...
Correct.
Okay,
Unless their wife changes their purse, which, you know, that's... I've done cars that match people's purses. So, I mean, it's incredible.
Unbelievable.
But go back to, you know, I always say that, you know, the trades... We learn, the kids learn differently. So, you know, I was the student, and I tell this story all the time. My dog ran free, and I was tied to the tree. It's a true story because, you know, like a lot of kids that are in the trades, we couldn't sit still. We couldn't really pay attention to a blackboard. If it was something we liked, we did well in it. But that's where a lot of kids struggle. So that's how I really got into my automobile upholstery business was, I was working at Shaw's. I was in the pros department. I was sophomore year in high school. I was going to quit school. I'm one of four. My brother went to college. My sister went to college, and my other sister went to college. They're 5 years older than me, so I was the youngest. And my mother's like, no, you're graduating. So I said, well, I need to find something in school that makes me happy. So the trades came into my life with upholstery, Scott's, with auto body. And they were smart enough to put that at the end of my day. So I got so intrigued with the class that I actually showed up. And I graduated. But how I got into upholstery was, one day there was a little business card on the door that said, sweeping the floors out of an upholstery shop. So I went there and I took that job at 14 years old. Fast forward, 19 years old, out of high school. If you're old enough to remember the 80s, 87, we had a really bad economy. It crashed. I had $3,000. I got laid off and I started my upholstery company when I was 19 years old with $3,000. That was 35 years ago in December.
Same location?
No, I started in Greenland out of a one bay garage with a, actually my office was big, my office was bigger than my garage.
Yeah.
And then in 95, I met my wife and we bought the place in Rye and I built
right.
my upholstery shop there.
Right. So just so you know, yeah, I am a little bit older and very similar. I didn't do the greatest in school. I knew that there was no way my parents behind me were going to let me, you know, quit.
Yep.
Not that that was an option, but with my father and everything else, yep. just like not going to happen. And I started Reddit Cable with no background whatsoever.
Continental
Cablevision. Yeah. Okay. With no background whatsoever. So what did you get laid off at? And what was that amazing leap of faith? Because I know that you talk about the support and that seems yep. to be woven in.
Yep.
I, you know, looking at your board of directors,
yep.
and I know that also too, reading some of the other research on you, that Sherry and Riley, your son,
mm-hmm.
very much part of this whole,
oh, yes.
let's
oh,
say,
yes.
evolution of Steve.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Okay? So, but there's some of that in you, it's in your
oh,
DNA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
So, you make that leap of faith.
Yep. Well, it was thrown at me. So, I got laid off, 19 years old. Had money in the bank. My father came to me and said, hey, I have this little garage that you can rent for $150. Do you want to do it? And back then, I mean, I was doing a convertible top a day, which was, I mean, back then they were $300 a day. I'm like, oh, I can easily do this. I spent the $3,000 in a week and then I was broke.
Oh,
for all the materials.
Yeah.
And I had to go out literally, and I've never been a salesman. I'm still today not a salesman. You come to my shop for something, I will give you what you ask for. I will not upcharge you. I just don't believe in that. So I had to literally go to Portsmouth Hospital, do this, do that, and sell myself. And it was successful, but I tell my son, I actually, you know, I was renting an apartment, you know, because of business, ran out of money. I lived in my shop for a year. I took a shower under a garden hose outside because I had no money. I lived in my shop for a whole year to keep the business going. So, I mean, I've been at the bottom and I've been at the top. And then, you know, in 2008, I was at the bottom again. I mean, I've seen it all. That's why I always succeed in life, because I just won't give up. I just won't.
You know what? I'm going to be honest with you,
yep.
too. And I'll show you the notes right here. You have a relentless pursuit of excellence. That's kind of, if you read through anything,
yep.
that you do that. Okay, so now your shop, is you have a partner?
Yep.
A business partner?
When I first started?
Yeah.
I still don't. I'm still just me.
Okay. So
100%
me. Maybe who's Ryan?
Okay. Ryan was with me for 18 years.
Perfect. Okay.
Yep. I got him in 2005.
Okay.
So I ran the shop for 17 years by myself.
God bless you.
Literally, like, you know, every other small business owner, I would, like, my son was my life. Like, you know how it is.
Absolutely.
I coached Little League. I did all that. I would literally close the shop. Go coaches. I coached every sport. I coached Little League. I mean, everything. And then I'd come back and I'd work all night long. And that's where my ultra running goes, because I don't require a lot of sleep. I can work on 3 hours of sleep. It's getting harder as I get older.
Right.
But I would literally close the shop at 4:30, go do the Little League thing, come back at 8 o'clock and work all night long. You know, I didn't have weekends because I had to work. So for 17 years, I ran that whole place by myself.
Wow.
Yeah, and then
wow.
I had Ryan for 18 years. He left me. He didn't leave me. His daughter got pregnant in North Carolina, and his wife wanted him to be closer. So he left, and now I have another guy that runs the shop with me. But I'm still there every day, on the floor, cleaning the bathrooms. I mean, I don't watch people work. I work.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. And you have, and following you, if anyone follows you on Facebook too, you're very...
Particular?
well, not so much particular. I think what it is you, how can I word it? You're very humble at the same time,
yep.
but you know that you deliver a quality yes. product from the business standpoint. Yep. And, you know, and it, I see you take pride in your employees as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other piece. And I guess now we'll kind of migrate a little yep. bit so we can kind of intertwine mm-hmm. The two of the three circles. Looking for help or looking for a Ryan replacement, yep. did that kind of
before
accelerate?
That, before
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So what happened was working by myself, could never get the work done, then got Ryan, got even busier. Because now he was working 40 hours a week, we could actually start producing.
Yep.
We were doing, I wouldn't say better work, but it was better because he was working 40 hours a week. The work was getting better. I was always by myself trying to get things done. You know, it's not easy when you're trying to do everything yourself. So then in, what was it? I'm trying to think of what year it was, 2015, I was really struggling to get the work done, even with Ryan, and I kept saying to everybody, I need to grow the business. That's when I got a couple kids in there. They wouldn't stay. Every other business. So that's when the Bring Back the Trades started coming in, was 2015, 2016, the thought of it. And Bring Back the Trades to what it is today, and that's another story we'll try and get into, was never, like, even in the cards. For what it is today, was never even in the cards. So that evolved on its own.
So... And that's, we were talking, Jeff and I were talking, it's like, you've got some heavy hitter sponsors
oh,
as well.
Big time,
So you have some believers in the
it's
program.
Little, it's almost nerve-wracking because it's like, I put on Facebook last night, I created a monster, a happy monster, but it's a monster.
But it's probably a good problem to have. And, and once again, I see on your board of directors, Sherry's there,
yep.
Matt's there, which we'll get into Matt
yep.
on the running side
yep.
of it. But so... How, I guess...
How did that become?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
So let's talk...
Yeah. I will try and make that as quick as possible because that
Take
is...
Take your time.
Okay.
With no timetable.
So I woke up August... I don't know exactly what the date was. I think it was like 27th, 2017. And called my guy that does all my embroidery work. And I said to Rich. Rich Riley. You know Rich Riley?
I know Rich
okay.
Riley.
So he did all my embroidery. I said, Rich, I want a baseball cap that says Bring Back the Trades. And he says, why? I said... I still, to this day, don't know why. I don't. I said, just make me up a baseball cap that says Bring Back the Trades. And he says, well, what do you want on it? I said, what do you mean? You need a logo. I said, surprise me. So I have the original hat. So a friend of mine just brought it back to me. And I went to pick it up. And it said, Bring Back the Trades. And it had a wrench and a hammer on it. And I was wearing it. And then one of my good friends, Joe Tucker, which is he builds expensive houses in Rye, came by to pick up his car. And he says, where'd you get the hat? And I said, I made it. He goes, I need 12 of them. I said, why? He goes, I talk about that every day. So when I said I made the hat, it wasn't about like bringing back the trades. It was
yeah.
just a hat. So I said, okay. So I called Rich. I said, can I have 12 more hats? He goes, why? I said, Joe Tucker wants them. So I call him up, give him the hats. Joe comes by, picks them up. And I'd say, I don't know the exact time, a couple weeks by, his electrician comes by and says, hey, saw the hat you made for Joe with the hammer and the wrench. Can you put an electric bolt on there and make it an electric hat? Still no idea. I said, fine. I said, I got to make 12 of them at a time. He goes, okay. So I call Rich. He's like, what are you doing? I said, I have no idea. Next week, welder comes by. Fast forward, I got 47 hats. Then a friend of mine comes by and says, hey, why don't you create a Facebook page and start selling them? So... create a Facebook page or Facebook group,
yeah.
which is still on there.
Right.
And we start selling. Go to my bank, create an account that's Bring Back the Trades, start putting the money in there, still just not doing anything with it. And then I think it was Jason Bronski. He gives
no
me
Jason
a,
well.
Gives me a check for $500. And I said, well, what are you doing with this? He's like, I need some hats too. So we made him up an auto body hat. Dell Record, one of my good friends, comes by one time and he says, hey, what are you doing with all this money? If you ever met Dell, he's right to the point.
I know who Dell is, yeah.
He goes, what are you doing with the money? I said, I'm just putting it into the bank. He says, hey, I have an idea for you. I said, what? My mother passed away. She left us some money. We don't need it. I'm going to go over to the Portsmouth High School because my father was a welder. I'm going to give the money to the...
Your father was a welder or
no, Dell's? No, Dell's father was a welder.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
I'm going to take the check and I'm going to go over there and I'm going to give it to him for a scholarship. Why don't you start selling the hats and create a scholarship fund? So that's how Bring Back the Trade. So Joe Tucker asked for the hats, right? Dell asked me in... So I make the hats. Joe comes by, takes the hat, starts producing them. People come by. Dell tells me to start the scholarship fund.
Right.
So I didn't come up with the idea. I didn't.
But you're a humble guy. So let's fast forward a yep. little bit, and we'll throttle back yep. afterwards to today.
Yep.
$100,000 in scholarships. Yep. 45 is the last count that I was able to.
Yeah, I think we're at 45 right now.
Yeah, 45 people.
Yep.
Are benefiting from your. I'm going to say open ears and willingness to listen to other people.
Yep.
You've helped 45 young people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an amazing amount of humbleness to now what you're doing with all the merchandise.
I don't want to interrupt you because I'm 57 years old, but I don't feel it
yep.
because I take care of myself. But I get emotional because I'm still, when I give that money to that kid, you know, I always tell my wife, you know, she's like, oh, we're doing great. I'm like, you never know. You just never know. Tomorrow the bottom could fall out and I have no work because I'm in one of those businesses that the light goes off when financial things hit. A lot of my people, they stock money pays for their stuff. So what I'm saying is when I give a scholarship to a kid, I still see myself. And that's why I work so hard because every person that I've given a scholarship to, they really desperately need it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what really drives me, and I'm hoping to do, is give out more because we're getting 300 scholarship essays a month.
That's the amazing thing, too, is going on your website, you know, and seeing how I like the fact it's not just filling out this. It's you're asking for an essay or a video.
Mm-hmm.
So let's it's an interaction as opposed to not a job interview. But I see what you're saying, too, because now there's 299. That you can't help.
Yeah, and what scares me is the best story I have for success, well, I've had multiple of them, but for Bring Back the Trades, I called up a girl to give her scholarship, and she was crying. And I thought she was crying because she was happy. She was crying because her last $1,500, or I can't remember exactly what was due, but it was past due. She had one semester left. And they were gonna say, if you can't pay the loan, you're gonna have to not go to school. So she's going to school for welding. I give her the money. She graduates. She's in a job making over $100,000 a year. So what I'm saying is, it might not have, if I didn't give her that money, she might. And I don't like to put down anybody that works. But she might have worked at Walmart for the rest of her life and just been negative and upset and not succeeded. So that's why I work so hard because. That money can change somebody's life.
And I completely agree with you. It's not, we're not knocking anything of where somebody works, but
it's the career.
Correct. Yeah. And if you can change somebody's life like that,
yep.
and your humbleness is mind blowing to me because what you're doing.
My parents have, you know.
Yeah.
My parents, my father, and it's funny because my father worked at a rubber plant. And I remember picking up, you know, he worked his butt off. That we didn't have a lot of money. I mean, I've got that story. We didn't have a lot of money. Me and my brother lived in, you know, a pull-out couch and in an apartment. So, I mean, I've been from the rock bottom, and I've always been told myself that, you know, never forget where you come from.
Right.
Ever.
You know, and we were talking early before you got here, was that somebody can take a plumbing apprenticeship
mm-hmm.
program
mm-hmm.
and make so much more money, and it changed to your point. Now you're changing somebody's life,
yep.
as opposed to
well,
so
it's not that, too. It's I'm trying to break the chain. Like, I was an alcoholic,
okay.
So, not to jump around, but now my son,
no, this,
my,
this, this, my is, son, this is your story,
and
man.
My son never saw me drink. So, hopefully, you know, and I know the chain has been broken. So, but my father was an alcoholic, his mother was an alcoholic, I was an alcoholic, nobody else in my family was. But I always call it breaking the chain because it's poverty. So these kids that I'm giving scholarships to are coming from poverty. Now they're getting a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're making $150,000 a year. Now their kids won't be in poverty. So it's kind of breaking the chain of poverty.
That's a great way to look at it.
You know, because if they don't, say they work at Walmart, and I, like I said, anybody that works, I don't want to put them down, but they'll never be out of poverty. They go into the trades, they make good money, they have a family, and they can afford their kids to go to college or, you know, a trade, or because we don't put down college because my son went to college, so we don't want to put down college. So they could go to college, they could go to a trade, they could do whatever, but it's breaking the chain of poverty. The trades have to be looked at totally different, that it's not, you know, if you can't make it in college, that it's the only job, because it's not.
Yeah, it's, and how do I, and I don't want to sound like I'm hypocritical, because no. I had to get a degree to be able to become a funeral director. You
and
had that, to
and
do it.
And that's why I say, it, because I'm working with Chuck Lloyd, he's in charge of the Hampshire Technical Institute, where we're having the Mike Rova.
Yeah.
And he came over.
And we're going
to
talk about that as well.
And he came over and he said, Steve, you've been using this, you know, we're not against college and you don't have to go to college. Steve, stop. Please stop saying that, because a lot of your trades require college. So I got to really train myself that, you know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, you don't have to go to college to make money, which a lot of these trades, building trades, you require college, like what you're saying.
Yeah. At the same time, too, where I was going to go with it, quite honestly, is there's kind of, I've talked to a few people within the funeral service.
Yep.
That actually want to make it a certificate type program, because the problem is like, just like everything else in, there's improvements on every product.
Yep.
So the science is, the science of embalming, is not as, it's still a complex thing to do.
Yep.
But a lot of the products that we use do all the scientific and degree type stuff. I learned more from Tom LaBerge in my 2 years of apprenticeship with him than I learned at school.
And we'll get into that too, because I mean, like I said, I started this in 2017. I've learned so many things about, you know, what the problems are to bring back the trades. It's not just getting kids to go to trade schools. It's so much bigger than that.
Right.
It really is.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I have a son. I have teachers that have said, very similar to what you said, I'm listening and thinking about Dylan, is they thought he was borderline genius, or they didn't want him in his class, in the class. Just because it's the same thing. It's like he learns like you and I did.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And there are, he's now on his own, self-taught, changing brakes on his... And he wanted a project car. He bought an 87 Cadillac Elante.
Wow.
He's out in the parking lot changing the brakes. I'm going, dear God, please know what you're doing. And you know what? He's doing it.
Yeah.
He's just gotta
let him fail.
Yeah. And he didn't.
Well,
and
to a point, it's his brakes.
Yeah, it is his brakes.
To a point.
But it's just amazing when you put a tool in somebody's hand that has a desire.
And the tool is, you know, I always talk about self-confidence. I've got a couple girls that I'll talk about too, and that had no self-confidence until they got into the trades, and now their confidence is like, you know, and not to jump around, but why I have so much confidence in my life now is because of my running career. I mean, I grew up, I told you last night, I grew up the kid that was, you know, just no confidence whatsoever. I mean, it was awful. I mean, I still have it. Everybody thinks I've got it made. My life is so boring. I have two dogs that I run with.
Hulk and Brady.
Oh, yeah.
And one's going to be the sneaker and the other one's going to be a quarterback.
I mean, it's my life is so, other than bring back the trades, I mean, we go for our rides. I go for a ride with my dogs every day at 4:30. Then I take them for four runs a day and I do bring back the trades. Everybody thinks I have this like Tom Brady life. It's the most boring. I mean, it's not boring because of bring back the trades, but I'm just the normal guy. That's it.
But it's the humbleness just amazes me, like I said earlier, because, you know, You talk about the support, but you're also not going to let people down. That's what I see.
I refuse.
You know, from...
There is days that I want to, and believe me, I will be honest with you. There is days where... Okay, so February 17th of 2000... When was COVID? 19... So 20...
Everyone refers to 2020 as COVID, but we start seeing the strains.
So I want to say February 21, I'm out for a run. I had $500 in Bring Back the Trades account. Now we closed Bring Back. We didn't close it. We stopped giving out scholarships and asking for money during COVID because nobody's making any money. So I'm out for a run, coming up Grove Road, and I'm going to go home. I'm going to tell my wife. I'm going to give them $500 away, and I'm going to be done. I'm like, because I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm like, I'm the kind of person, I have to keep going. I can't let something go and then pick it up. So I come home. She goes, how was your run? I says, you know, I had a really good run, and I do most of my thinking when I'm running. So I go home. I said, she goes, how was the run? I said, great. I said, I'm going to give away the five, just like this. I'm going to give away the $500, and I'm going to call it a day. It's too much. She's walking away. She goes, wow, I've known you, whatever, 28 years, and I've never heard you ever say you're going to give up on something. Instantly, boom, turned around, went to Facebook, said, I'm back, let's go. I just heard those words, wow, you're giving up on something. Because I'm sure I've given up on something. We all have. Given up on sweets when I'm, you know, running. But that's what got me going. Those two words, or three words, you're going to give up.
And, from your biggest supporter.
Yeah.
From your biggest supporter.
She's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
She's seen me through the lowest and the highest and the lowest and the highest.
Yeah.
Yep.
Sherry's always by his side. Yeah. As in the.
And right now by her side because she just had surgery on her leg.
Everything going well?
Oh, everything's going great. Well, other than she can't move. And she's like me. It's hard to keep down.
Is she inactive?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. That's funny. So let's talk about it. And let's kind of bounce around.
Yeah.
So, and we'll circle back to some of this. So now let's talk about this huge event that you've got coming up in November.
Yeah. So it's called the New Hampshire's Bringing Back the Trades. It's at New Hampshire Technical Institute on November 15th. Starts at like 9:30 in the morning, but our special guest is Mike Rowe. So he's coming in. And how that started, you talk about the support. So Amanda Capone Toyota.
Capone, yeah.
She has been my biggest supporter, and I've never met her until this event. She texted me one night, or didn't text me, but she instant messaged me on LinkedIn. She goes, hey, I got an idea. Can I call you? It's fine. This is December. She goes, hey, my dealership's turning 100 years old on November 15th. I'm thinking about bringing Mike Rowe to the event. And then what I'm thinking of, having my event at night and have a Bring Back the Trades event during the day. Are you in? I said, absolutely. She goes, well, first let me tell you how much he costs. He costs $225,000 plus $25,000 to get him there. So $250,000. I said, we can get that. That's no big deal. So we went to work, and that was December. So when we started really putting the package together to start putting, you know, sponsorships together, say we raised the money in a month and a half, 2 months.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, and now I don't know what the number is, but it's, I want to say it's well over $500,000 we raised. So he's completely paid for.
Do you see this as like a yearly thing? Not necessarily with Mike Rowe, but now with you, the Grapponi partnership.
Yeah, so the New Hampshire's, what we've talked about, so Tracy Pendleton, she's in charge of ProCon. She is, you know, Amanda's great, I'm great. Tracy is, I never thought I would meet somebody that could outwork me, and she outworks me. Like, she is incredible. So she pretty much runs the whole show. I do all the invoicing, all of that, and, you know, I'm going to do the actual event. That's what I do. I set up events and all that, and I set the tents and all that. But she does all the administrative stuff, and there is, between her, my wife, and Amanda, but Tracy kills it. I can't say enough about this woman. She is a rock star.
Wow.
I mean, huge. So that's how the event happened. It's another thing that fell in my lap.
Like I said, humbleness. So she calls you into December.
Yep.
So so how far into it before you know you got the commitment from him? So were you? So you're in essence.
Yep.
In a way.
Well, we contacted him before we started talking to sponsors.
All right. Secure him first. You secure the event. Then how does that
We secured him first and worked backwards.
So you did.
Because you have to secure him, because if you're taking $250,000 from people. Amanda, she has a lot of heavy hitters. So we got 10 $25,000 sponsors. So, I mean, it's being sponsored, but it's a big, big event.
Well, that's a thing that Jeff and I were talking about. Even your sponsors are our heavy hitters. I know kind of touched on it a little bit, but that's a real deal. It's not, what you're doing, people believe in, and I just think.
And this is the resume, because what we like to do, like Doug, which is my board member, which is the driver of the number 98, bring back the trades car from Trans Am. He is now pretty much, he'll probably take over the vice presidency the next term. But he is working on having an indoor event in New York City. What I really want to do, because right now the one we're having now is November. It's going to be outside in under tents, two tents. But what I want to do is I want to have one in Boston inside.
Like at the Expo or the Heinz Center or something.
But it takes millions of dollars to do that. We'll get there. What the best thing about this event we're having, we'll have a resume after this is done. Not only will we have Mike Rowe, and Mike Rowe paid for, we'll have a resume to say, okay, we've done it. Here it is.
You guys are players in the game, lack of a better term.
Exactly. But you have to, like, I've done five of the small ones, all successful. Every one of them has, you know, the people that are involved, not every one of them, but we had five vendors at my last one get kids signed up and jobs. We've had the best thing is we had our last one at SeQuel School of Technology, and I put Oxford Builders in front of the construction. They now are having a apprenticeship is something else.
Yeah.
An internship with SST for the kids that are working in the construction. So I put them together. Like I said, I didn't do it. I just was smart enough to put the construction company in front of the building trades school, and they worked with each other. But only that, a kid that's now giving back to me, Nate Ferrello, is now their first intern from that event. So it's all about networking. It's all about putting, you know, everybody says, oh, you did this. I'm like, no, I just did it and it happened. I mean, it's,
okay.
It's true, though.
I read on your website, you do mention the connections and the mentorship. Yeah. That is like a big part of your program.
Yeah.
Do most of those like connections and like the internship program you just mentioned, does that usually come from your events?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's another thing. So we partnered with Milwaukee. Right now, we're hoping in another month, where Milwaukee is powering our website. So it's being brand new. It's being built. What the best part about our new website is going to have a drop-down menu that you can put in your zip code. You can find a school near you. You can get a full live Zoom mentorship, and then you get a scholarship, and then you can get a job after that worldwide, powered by Milwaukee. So we're using their database and all that. So we're working. And here's another one. I mean, you're going to say I'm humble, but Doug is good friends with somebody higher up in Milwaukee, and he got that. So I can't take any credit for that because he did all that. But it is going to be so powerful because they talk about the one-stop shop. So we'll be able to, you know, because I get an email from a mother, and I get a lot of from moms. I just do. Hey, my son wants to do welding. I went to the school. I don't know what to do. I don't know anything near me. And I'll say, okay, what zip code are you in? So I'll go on Google, because a lot of people, they don't even know how to do that.
Right.
I'll find a welding school 5 miles from there. And I don't like to put down schools because my wife works at a school. They're all overworked. It's not that teachers don't want to help. Everybody's running thin.
Completely different change world.
You know, and I'll be at a after-hours school. I was at, where was I? It was in Newport, New Hampshire at a school event. Like, school event where they teach trades. And I'm with my wife, with my apparel. And I have a parent come up to me and, yeah, my son's taking the building trades class. And where do we go from here? I'm like, what do you mean? Well, they don't have any clue, especially if they've never been in the trades. If they grew up and their parents were like in database or whatever, they know nothing. They're left out. So that's what this new website's going to be. It's going to be like to help you find, you know, a school, then it'll help you find a job. But the biggest thing is a mentorship, because that's what we talk about. You know, without a good mentor, which you know how it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I, you know, G&L, where I worked as a kid for the first 5 years, I had five guys razz the crap out of me because you could back then, but I love it. But they taught me. They took me under their wing and they taught me.
Yeah.
That's what the kids need. But, you know, we also need good, and that's where I'm going to be really, whoever I work with, we want good mentors. Really good ones.
So it almost sounds like, and if I can pull back a little bit, it almost seems like what you're doing now too is you're starting to educate the kids and show them where the options are. Well, that's where I'm going with it. Okay. It's like you're almost now having to educate the parents to help the kids. Yes.
Well, what I found was it wasn't a kid problem. And it depends on where you live. Like in my town, I love my town to death, and it's not their fault.
Just slow down when Steve's running, damn it.
Yes, yeah, believe me. It's not a parent's fault if they grew up in financial districts.
Correct.
They don't know. I will try and change the stigma because they don't, you know, I'm not saying they all don't, but some of them don't respect the trades. So, but I don't like to put that on everybody. But I don't even know where I was going with that. But
helping the parents.
It's the parents because they don't know. They think of the trades like my grandfather or my father coming home from a place all dirty. You know, it's dirty, and it's cold, which it is. The trades, I won't sugarcoat it. You have to be ready for it. But I'm trying to get to the parents. That's what our events are for. Come by. You know, I say, have you been in your basement to look at your boiler? It's all computerized. Your kid loves computers. It's all computer. I says, do you have an app for your thermostat? Yeah. I said, no shit. Sorry about that.
No. You're fine.
But it's all computerized. It's not a dirty, dingy job. It can be. Believe me, if you're a paver, you're going to be hot. You're going to be cold. If you're a roofer, that's another thing. When a parent comes by to me and says, hey, I want to talk to you about the trades. I say, okay. What do you think my son or daughter would be good at? The first question I ask is, when they get off the school bus, what do they do? What do you mean? What do they do? Are they playing basketball? Are they building a fort? Or are they downstairs constantly on the Xbox? Why? Because if they're outdoors playing basketball, they could be doing construction because cold weather doesn't affect them. Now, if they're downstairs and they don't like the cold, manufacturing will be great because they're inside. They're working with computers. You got to be able to figure out what the kid's going to be because you don't want to spend money and time sending them to a plumbing school if they're not the kind of kid that can be outside.
You know, you say that too, because when I started working for Continental, I got hired right out of high school. I was, and I got trained in the winter. And one of the guys who, in fact, I consider very much a mentor, I was talking to him last night. He's the one that said to me, he goes, you're coming at the great time. He goes, you're being trained in the middle of the winter. When spring comes, you're going to be a rock star. Lo and behold, he had more faith in me than I had in me.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, spring came, well, I hit that ground running.
Oh, yeah. It's like an ultra race. They put all the crap at the beginning. They don't put it at the end. Well, some of them, believe me, some of the races, they put it throughout the whole race. But most of the races you run, everything's at the beginning because you have no gas at the end. You know?
That's amazing. So let's shift gears a little bit for the running.
Yep.
And we're going to touch on your humbleness again. Yep. How does one pole to second pole go to 240 freaking miles?
It's all because, you know, like I said, that's another thing. I've been sober 24 years. So it's all the same stuff. You're constantly, for people like me, and I found most of the ultra runners that I've run with are all fighting addiction, or they're fighting divorces, every single person I've ran with in a race has a story, and it's a fighting story. So I think it all started the goal was, when I first started running, was to get healthy. I was 240-something pounds.
So you lost a small child. I'm not trying to be funny by any means, but you lost a small child.
Quickly. Because you know why? I gained it because I stopped drinking. I was pretty much what I am now my whole life. When I stopped drinking, I replaced it with sugary treats. I was literally eating a gallon of ice cream every night. Then a cake. I mean, I was every night stuffing my face because it was drinking is for me was I drank alone most of the time, so it was my alone time. And still, I'm up every night by myself on the couch, you know, not eating sweets as much, but it's my alone time.
But with your, I won't say a new lifestyle, but with what you're doing now, you couldn't and do what you're doing.
And that's why I do 100-mile races in 250s. And this is, I'm not trying to sound cocky, but, you know, I run every day. So if I don't put a long race in my schedule, I will gain the weight back again. I know I will.
Because I was surprised, too, as one of your posts says something, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, you're back.
Yeah.
You had a new goal.
Yeah.
So the other thing, too, is I want to kind of find out is like, let's talk about nutrition. How do you train?
I don't.
So from like, okay, so.
I don't have any nutrition whatsoever.
So how do you.
Yep.
Because, and one of the things I did find out as I was kind of, I'm not going to lie, I don't want to just come into a conversation cold. So I want to be able to have some, one of the toughest things to do in sports.
Yep.
It's not hitting a baseball. Nope. It's not ice skating and carrying a hockey puck. It's the will. It's the head. The toughest, the most difficult thing to do in sports is to run a marathon. Now, you're doing that times 10.
I'm doing 5 a day, something like that. I have to do 60 miles a day. So what is that?
That's Will's going to say 3 marathons a day.
Yeah, through 106-degree temperatures and snow. Every other than the Vermont 100 that I run, that's usually in July. Every long distance race, like the Canada one, that I will talk about that one.
Yeah, but
that's my hardest one. Moab, my first time. I mean, we'll talk about that, but that was through the desert. I mean, I got dehydrated multiple times. I had so much blood on my feet. I mean, it was. I look back now and I'm like, I don't even know how I did it.
So how do you prepare the body and the mind without having the backup? Because I mean, you know, everyone talks about, well, carbohydrates. How do you prepare your freaking body to start running on Friday and you're not going to stop until Tuesday and take 2 90-minute naps? How does the psyche work?
Let's go back to the first race. So, well, Vermont 100 was my very first race that I did. That was 100 miles.
Yeah.
That one is kind of my most proudest one, and that's kind of got a weird story to it. So that's a race that if you run it under 24 hours, you get a big belt.
Right.
That was my goal, okay? So I started off running with one of my friends that I trained with, and, you know, you'll ask Matt, I have a hard time leaving somebody.
And that's the other thing, too. I want to talk about Matt a little bit, but keep going. Sorry.
So I'm running with this guy, and he's having a tough time. And he's like, just leave me. And I'm like, no. We train together. So finally, I'm like, you know, this is really starting to hurt me because I'm really starting to lose the time. So I left him at mile 35. And, like, I'm looking at my time to go on to 24 hours. And it'll tell you on your app how far behind you are. So I start running and running and running. I'm starting to catch up. Well, I got to mile 75, and I pushed myself so hard that my legs, I could walk, but I couldn't run anymore. It was like really like cramping and like that. So I came in, and I had plenty of time to finish. I mean, it wasn't a matter of this 30-hour race. Mm-hmm. So I come in to my wife, and I said, I'm not going to finish under 24 hours. I just can't do it. I'm in so much pain. So she goes, that's fine. I said, and I was like all bloody because I didn't know how to run back then. So I used Vaseline and I didn't use KT tape. I knew nothing about it. So, I mean, it was bad. So then I'm like, started thinking about, oh, this is going to suck. I'm not going to do it at 24. And I started getting really mad at myself. So this is one of those things in life you still don't understand how it happened, but this is long hill. And I said, screw it. I'm just going to run down the hill as fast as I can and see what happened. And I'm telling you, this is a true story. Running down the hill in the most pain, it felt like seriously somebody was taking ice picks and hitting my legs as hard as they could. I mean, it was the most painful thing. And it was probably, I don't know, 0.2 down, not even that far. And as I'm running, both legs came right out of it. No pain whatsoever. Pain was gone. Obviously, now I know what it was. They were just, it was the lactic acid, and I was just running out of it. And of course, I can tolerate a lot of pain too. So I start running, and I'm running. I'm doing an 8-minute mile, and I'm starting to catch up time.
Now, we're past the 75-mile mark.
I'm at 80-something miles.
And you're running 8-minute miles.
Oh, yeah. You got to average a 14-minute mile to come under 24. So I come in, and I had. I think there was 5 miles left, so mile 95. my wife and my sister are there, and they're grabbing my pack off, and it's 3:30 in the morning. And the guy, this is the guy, I wrote an email to him because he's the one that got me to the finish line, under 24. He says, you got 5 miles left, you got 45 miles, do not stop. Pack, I'm like ripping like out of my wife, I'm like, right. Do not take it off. And I start running. I finished the race with 8 minutes under 24 hours.
Holy
so I did it.
Shit. Sorry, so we both swore.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and I, you know, the funny thing, like, I talked to a lot of sports people, and I'm like, both legs came out of the pain, like, simultaneously. And I'm like, how does, I'm not a big, you know, whatever, but
yeah.
I don't get into the spiritual stuff. But
not,
like,
not the divine intervention,
yeah,
but what
like,
happened?
I still really think, I don't know. I don't know, but both legs came out at the same time. And I'm like, how does that happen, both legs? So I did that one under 24 hours. But if it, you know, I always think about, if it wasn't for the guy saying, you can do this, I probably would have stopped.
Right.
So that guy, so I found him. I said, I got to find this guy. And I found him, and I sent him the biggest thank you. And I said, I just want you, because people love to know that they help people.
Right.
I said, because of you, I finished under 24 hours. And he goes, that just made my day. Because he goes, you got 45 minutes to do 5 miles, which easily for me, but when you're at mile 95,
that's the process that I'm trying to figure out, because to do it at that point,
yep,
like you said, yep, it's just,
but I'll top it. So my last race, and I'll talk about the ones in between. So the QMT last year, so this year, you know, I can tell the true story. This year it wasn't my heart. This year my mother got extremely sick at mile 65. I came off of the hill to get her to the doctor. So yeah, that's the true story.
And one of the finishes, and correct me if I'm wrong, your mom came across the finish line,
yes,
with you.
Yes, she came. That was mid-state, which I'm actually doing in October again this year.
That's pretty cool.
So last year, QMT, it is the hardest 100-mile race, supposedly, on the Northwest. It's 100 miles. It's 40 hours. It's 28,000 feet of elevation. You're running up hills
the whole time.
Just
yeah,
constantly. And you know, I don't train for hills. I don't.
See, and that's the part that amazes me, is you sit there and you look at just the 240 for those many days, right, Jeff?
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how does Tom Brady do what he did? I mean, there is skill there. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But he got up every day. I've trained. I look back. I would do 100-mile weeks.
So with that being said then, And let's face it, we're only in, how old were you when you started running again?
45.
Yeah, so
I was 45, 46, yeah.
As we get old, we don't.
But I've been a physical guy. I've been in and out of cars my whole life.
Yeah.
So I do yoga all day long.
Okay.
I got an 18-90 house. I was on a ladder. So yeah, I was a construction worker.
Yeah.
That's skinny. I hate to say it, but, you know.
So is there any, and I know you don't read,
yep,
as you said, you don't read books.
My wife is after me because she's like, we have to do, I mean, do you ever, you know David Goggins? Okay, you know him? Okay, so he ran, he's the reason why I ran the Moab 240. David Goggins is a two-time finisher of, what's the race that he ran? Not the race, but he did the, look him up. He's the military, but he did the, it's only got to do it twice. The SEALs.
Okay.
They have to do the, whatever it is to become a SEALs. But he's the only person to ever do it twice. He was 300 and something pounds multiple times. He is a beast. Like, beast. But let me get back to the QMT.
Yes.
So, the QMT is a 40-hour race, 27,000 feet of elevation. So, last year, if you remember last summer, it rained constantly. We literally ran 75 miles of mud. Like mud. People were dropping out at mile 20. 157 started, 50 finished. It was unbelievable. Like, it was the hardest race. I've done 257. This was the hardest race mentally, not physically. Mm-hmm. You're sliding all over the place, but most people are like, I can't do this anymore. It was just incredible. So I pick up my pacer at mile 65. We start climbing. We're doing good. And we're almost on schedule. And then all of a sudden, 3 o'clock in the morning, it starts pouring. Like, literally pouring. We're running through water up to our knees through the race. We come to mile, I can't remember, 78, 80. The bridge is knocked out. Nobody can get across. It's that bad. So we finally said, they said, well, we're going to give you extra time. And I'm looking, I'm going, I don't care about the extra time. I'm not going to finish. I've never not finished a race. I am literally freaking out. I said, Matt, we got to do something here. And he's like, what do you want to do? I said, we have to start running as fast as we can. So we find the bridge. We start running. And we got into a rhythm. The last 12 miles of my race was the fastest of my whole race. We came in with 2 hours left in the race. So we came in at 38 hours. But it was so, like, I slipped. I fell. I mean, and that's another thing. I mean, I'm knock on wood. I've never hurt myself. Other than my 257, I fell off a cliff. And yeah. I didn't, like, literally hurt myself. But I got really scared that I was going to really hurt myself.
Right.
That's the only race that I really did pull myself out. And I pulled myself out for my family, not me. But that race was literally like running through mud constantly, like falling, like just unbelievable. But these races, you know, my whole life has been, you know, up and down, up and down. So it's just a race. It's just a day.
It just amazes me because I was waiting for this nutritional readiness. So, like, if you're coming up to, so like that Friday, yep. say your race is going to be that Friday.
Yep.
Is there anything during the week that you may?
Nope. When I first started running, I've never measured anything. I eat a lot of chicken. I shouldn't say eat red meat because I do have a cheeseburger, but I don't have steak. I don't have anything, like, I don't do a lot of cheese. I do watch what I eat, but I don't watch what I eat. I've never, like, I get to a race and I laugh because, you know, Matt is, like, so prepared. He's, like, so prepared for everything. I'll go there with my backpack and just my shoes and I go. I'm just that. But most ultra runners, that's what we are. We're out there just, and that's the one thing I love about ultra runners. We don't compete against each other.
You're competing against yourself.
Yep. And we help each other. I mean, I don't know how many times I've watched people stop for hours to help somebody that's hurt. They don't care. They know they're going to get there. But it's you spend, like, I ran with this woman. She was 65 years old. I must have run with her for, I don't know, 10 hours. Because you run with people, and that's another thing I keep talking about, too. We don't run 257 miles. You start off running, then you're hiking, then you're climbing. And then you might run again. You are running, but when I say, people say, oh, you ran 257 miles. No, I didn't. You didn't.
And there's the humbleness coming through again. But I think that that's, you're part of a what's the word? Maybe a society or whatever. That's, you got to look out for each other, you I think. To. Because, yeah. I mean, literally, it's the psyche of running that, whether you're running, walking, hiking. It is what it is. Your sleep deprivation is there.
You can't be afraid.
Yeah.
Because you're in situations like, my first Moab race, that was truly a family affair. My son went, my wife went, my two good friends from Utah, they took the week off. We all went out there. They took the van. They were with me the whole way. So literally, you know, my wife's afraid of heights. She said, after that one, she's like, I'm never doing a race with you again. You're done. You're flying out there. And she can't handle the stress of me. She, you know, I could do 1,000 of these, and she's afraid. She just thinks something's going to happen to me. And I'm like, I have a better chance to get hit by the dog. But it was a true family affair.
Team Turner, I remember it specifically following that.
It was incredible. I mean,
you sent out the trackers. People were checking in on you.
Yeah,
I was one of them.
I had the
police
escort me in. I mean, that's why I like to, you know, bring the whole thing into it to make everybody, because most people don't even, ultra running, what the hell is that? We're running for 5 miles. Why? You know, why?
So what was the mindset when Cindy, is sister Cindy that brought it to you?
Donna.
Donna, sorry. Yeah. brought it to you, how, because I mean, you very readily came on when I asked you to come on here. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Is that how quick the answer was when Donna brought that to you?
Yeah, well, how it started was, so I ran, my first goal, this is how this weird thing, so when I first started running telephone pole, my goal was, that was November, was to run the 10K Saunders Road Race in August.
Right.
I was running a marathon before that even happened. I mean, it was, yeah. And then I said, okay, I want to run the Boston Marathon. Donna's like, well, if you can do that, why don't you run the Boston Marathon? So, of course, you have to qualify for that. Mm-hmm. So I tried a couple times. I was missing it by like 5 minutes, which, you know, it's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. So I ran as a charity runner. And I came in, I think, what did I come in at? 3:44, and which was all right. So then the funniest thing is, I'd run that as a charity runner, and I had a Boston Marathon sticker on the back of my car. Good friend of mine comes in to have his Porsche done. He says, hey, you ran the Boston Marathon? I'm like, yeah. He goes, you ever thought about trail running? I'm like, what's trail running? He goes, trail running. I said, nah, I don't want to do trail running. So you should try this 50-miler in Ipswich, New Hampshire. So went down there. I'm like, started running. I'm like, oh, this is actually kind of cool. So I started training for that for 50 miles. And I was like really up in my mileage. So this is how the Boston Marathon happened. So the Newmarket Marathon is in October. It was the week before my 50. I said, I'm going to use that as a training run for my 50. Go out to have fun. I run it in 3:15.
Made up 5 minutes, didn't you?
No, I made up. No.
That's what I mean. I'm being facetious. Oh, yeah. You a half hour. So you almost took a half hour off.
And my sister's riding with me next to the bike, and I'm not even. I'm using it as a training run. Not even. I'm just having fun. She goes, "You just qualified for the Boston Marathon by a lot." I'm like, "What? Your time is 3:25 that you have to qualify. You did it in 3:50. You got 10 minutes. You're in." And I'm like, "Seriously?" She's like, "Yeah." So that's how I ran the Boston Marathon, by using the 50-mile race as a training run. And I tell everybody, when they go into a race, if you go into it to have fun, you'll do way better than if you try and do something.
Yeah.
It's a known fact. Yeah. So I ran the 50-mile race. Before I could even get done, my sister's like, hey, this is 100-mile Vermont race. You should do that. I'm like, I'm getting done. I can't walk. I'm like stiff. So then the next day, she sends me the video of it. So I sign up for that. So then I complete that. That's when we're up. I ride bikes with her. She's like, here, come back to the house and look at this David Goggins thing. And the one, he didn't succeed the first year. He got sick. She goes, you should really try that. So, of course, she didn't go with me. So I tried that. And then she's like, you should do this. So everything that I've done, other than the Cocodona 250, that was my own doing, that I did that. And I did that all by myself with no. Yeah. So that was the toughest. That was the toughest race, because flew out there, no crew, just my backpack, no pacer. That was the one I did. It was 116 hours with an hour and a half of sleep. Yeah.
How? Yeah. I'm amazed.
The reason why I did it is I got lucky. I don't say anything happens in luck. People are always in the right place. And I always say bad things happen for a reason. But we had an out and back. It was 8 miles back, out and 8 miles back. And I was walking with this Navy SEAL as we were coming in. And he had this girl with her. And she was his pacer. Well, she goes, hey, he's going to go meet his wife. And I've got my van here. Do you want to just lay down for a little while? I got to know her. And she's like, lay down. So I'm laying down. And I think the guy's wife wasn't too happy that he was going with her. So the wife comes over. She goes, Dave's all set. You know, he doesn't need a pacer. And I think that's the reason why. So she's like, she drove 3 hours. She goes, can I pace you? And I'm like, absolutely. So we go out and back. And on the way back, I hit like really, never hallucinated, but I hit a wall where I was just mentally gone. She got me to the aid station where I could sleep for an hour and a half. So she was there at the right. If I was with myself, I probably would have, who knows what would have happened. But she got me there.
So the function of a pacer,
yep.
And I know Matt does it for you,
yep,
occasionally.
Yep.
You've made reference to that a little,
yep,
bit. So what exactly is it? Someone that obviously looks out for you,
yes,
and you're not running solo,
yep,
or blind.
Yep.
What is the other function? Is it to let you know of your mileage, or trying to keep?
They technically, well, yes, they can keep track of your miles, but you know, they can't aid you anyway. They can't carry your stuff. They can't give you water. They can't help. If you get hurt, yes, they can help you, but they can't aid you. Yeah. They can't carry your stuff. They're more there like I will only really want a pacer like 24-hour race. I won't ask for one because I don't have a problem. But like a 40-hour race, that's like the QMT starts on a Friday night at 8 o'clock. So you'll have Friday night, Saturday night. You'll have two nights. So, and you're really pushing yourself. So what Matt does, yes, he keeps me company. He keeps me like, we'll talk and makes the, but he will literally stay in front of me and I'll be so tired that I'm looking at his feet. It's just, and then I don't have to navigate. So they can navigate for you. So you're coming up and there's constant turns. There's flags. Mm. You're not looking at your phone like a GPS. They're not talking to you. So you got to be paying attention. So a pacer is in front of you, like a car in front of you on the road that knows where they're going, but more to keep you sane.
So let me ask you this, because I know like at times, and we all need a little bit of sleep. I'm kind of similar to you, but as I'm getting older too, I'm finding, okay, I need four and a half.
Yeah.
My question, and everyone at work drives them nuts because I'm there before they are. Mm-hmm. And I leave when they leave. But here's my question too. Is it, when you're doing this, and I'm kind of going to go into the psyche side of it, I'm sure there's times like at 2 or 3 or 4 a.m.
From 11, depending on, okay, so from 11 to, if it's a July race, 3:30, the sky's already changing. As soon as that sky starts to get bright, I'm wide awake.
Okay. So do you have the same thing during, say, like when the sun's at its highest point? During the day, so it's really kind of more of a night.
I do get the sand in the eyes,
yeah,
but I don't get the same where I'm gonna fall asleep. I do. My eyes are like really tired, but I can stay awake. The nighttime from like sometimes 10 o'clock, and I just have to keep going. And once, like I said, it's weird. As soon as the sun comes up, and I'm not saying sun, you can start to see the trees again. I'm wide awake again.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
Wow.
I cannot, literally, unless I got the flu, I can't sleep during the day. No matter. And that's why the Cocodona, I only did it an hour and a half. Because what happened was, you'll come into an aid station, you know, if you have a crew, like my Moab, I slept for 10, I think it was either 8 or 10 hours during that 100, and I think that was 112 hours. But I slept as much as I wanted to, because when you have a crew, they take your backpack off, they charge your batteries, they give you your food. You can sleep with no problems because they're taking care of you when you're by yourself. Now, I carry all my batteries with me. They have to be recharged. My phone has, this right here, well, this is my new one. This will last a week, but my other ones would only last 18 hours. So you have to take them off. You have to charge them. You have to charge all your headlamps. So there's a lot of stuff you're doing, and then you're constantly, did I forget this? And me, I'm the person, I can't shut my brain off. So I'd come in during the day, and I can't sleep during the day. So I would maybe come in at night. And the trouble is, too, is at in the desert at night. You ever been in the desert at night? It's freezing.
Yeah.
If, and there's no tents, and I can't carry a sleeping bag. I got my, you know, bivy, which is like a marathon thing that goes around you. It doesn't really keep you warm. So there was a couple times where I'd lay down and put it around me, and then I'd start doing this, and I'm like, okay, time to get up, because once I start shivering, I can't get back again. So it's not that I couldn't sleep, I didn't have the time to sleep. Where it was like, if I could get into it, like where that girl got me to the thing, there was a tent with a sleeping bag, set my phone, it was a perfect way for
situation.
But when you're out there by yourself, it's not. So that's why I didn't sleep.
One more running question, and we'll kind of circle back into bring back the trades and the business side.
Yep.
When you sleep for 90 minutes and you've run, say, 60 miles.
Yep. 170 miles.
170, okay.
Whatever,
Oh, yeah. For me, I'm sitting there thinking 6 miles. But how the hell do you get your body that's now been at rest for 90 minutes going again, Steve?
Well, they say that you, no more than 90 miles, 90 minutes. Some people sleep longer than that. I got lucky. I got up, I think it was 4 o'clock in the morning. The wind was whipping. I set my phone. I'm like, oh, please go off. And it went off. And you're sitting there and you just like, I don't want to get I don't want to get up. But I wanted to finish so bad. If you want to finish something and if you want something so bad, it's like vacation. Nobody has a problem getting out of bed to go on vacation, right? They're up early. They don't even need the alarm clock. You know what I'm saying? The last day, the alarm clock, you know. But so I got up and I'm like, luckily, it was cold. And I think that was a lot of things. So I got up, instantly went over for the black coffee, had the coffee, called my wife, and it was 5 hours different, so it was 9 o'clock here. And started talking to her, take my mind off the body, started, you know, moving, and I was fine. I just, you know, it's...
That's amazing.
Yeah, but like I said, it's not... If I had... And that one, I was probably 30 miles of, like, not a lot of elevation. So it was a lot of walking and hiking. If I'd just done a, you know, huge climb and went to bed, maybe it would have been different because the legs would have been... The lactic acid would have been worse.
You may have cooled them down.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. My first Moab race, I literally came across the finish line, got into the car. We drove 3 hours back to the house. Took a shower. I woke up the next day. I wish I could show you a picture. My legs were this big. They swelled up. But that's because I didn't know what to do. Yeah. I'm like, I've learned so much. I tape my feet. I will literally run 250 miles. My feet will look perfect. It's all about taping your feet, taking your socks off, constantly, you know, getting the dirt out of your feet. I'll tape my whole back where my backpack hits. I use stuff, certain stuff for between my legs. I mean, you have to know what you're doing.
So that would be the advice to Steve now as opposed to Steve back.
My first Moab race, I ran 80 miles in the sand. I never took my sock. I mean, I knew I was getting blisters. I mean, I could feel them. Literally ask my wife. I took my shoes off at 3 o'clock in the morning at mile 80. I had blood blisters like this.
Is that the one where it refers to the fact that Sherry and Riley were taking blood, getting dirt out of your blisters?
Oh,
and,
yeah. I mean, the medics literally, I mean, my whole bottom, I mean, I look back now, I ran another, 220 miles? No, 100-something miles on those feet. My last 18 miles, I literally, you know, I just wanted to finish so bad, but it was like if I hit a rock, it was like, I was like walking on glass.
Wow.
But I didn't care because I wanted to, you know, when you're, I don't want to say this, but you're going, I'm doing something that none of my friends can do.
See, you know, it's funny.
And well, I want to interrupt, I don't want to say they can't do it because they can. They just choose not to.
Well, that it's because people sit there with the profession. I mean, I spent almost 30 with what became Comcast, yeah, and coming into the funeral service, and they're like, why? It's like, because I can.
Yes.
So I get that piece of it. The gruelingness that you've is amazing, what you've put your body through. It's just phenomenal. What I wanted to, so the next one, what's your next race?
Mid-State 100 starts in Ipswich, New Hampshire, and ends in Douglas State Park in Connecticut. And you think of Connecticut, it's the edge of Connecticut.
So but it's and that's the one that goes to it goes a little bit multiple states,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because it's not. It's like if you went to Greenland, it was Northampton. You know, that's what it is.
Okay.
You're running through the woods and you see a rock that says all three. It's like they make it sound like you're going to be running through all this stuff, and you know. And I do want to sub this up. Anybody can do what I do because I ran with a woman in the Cocodona 250. She had no legs. She was a I don't know what branch of military she was in. She had two fiberglass legs. Not only did she finish, she had an American flag over her shoulder and ran the whole way without the flag touching, with no legs. So what I'm saying is, if you want something, yes, you have to be in good shape. You can't be overweight. And I mean, I'm not saying that, but you do have to be in good shape. The 65-year-old woman I ran, 5'2", if you went and saw her right there, you'd be like, there's no way you just ran that. You can do it.
Yeah.
You can. Yeah. You have to be a hiker and all that, but I have a friend that runs, they do the Appalachian Trail all the time. Like, you could do this. Oh, I could never do it. I'm like, yeah, you can. You can.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yep.
Okay, so you got the micro event. Now we're going to bounce back up. You got the micro event.
Yep.
You have a goal of either Boston or New York. When did you realize you had something outside of the hat piece for Bring Back the Trades?
That's a good question. Nobody's asked me. That's a really good question.
Because it seems like, you know, I tried, and I'm going to be honest with you. I went back on some of the posts, and all of a sudden it was like a, for lack of a better term, a popcorn kernel just went boom, and you're nationwide, my friend.
I did the nationwide thing. You know, everybody fought me on that. They were like, no, we got to keep this in New Hampshire. And I'm like, you know, when I bought the trailer,
yeah,
all the funds from the trailer were, for, you know, I do a lot on LinkedIn. Where most of my money comes from is LinkedIn. Most of my money from that trailer came from California, Nebraska. And I'm like, okay, so if I'm taking all this money from other people, I have to help them. You have to give back.
You got a great mind, man.
So I fought, you know, it's funny. I'm the smallest business person, but I'm not the most successful person. I'm not a millionaire, and I don't, money doesn't mean anything to me, but it's like, I know how to make things work.
You got a niche. You got a niche, man.
And that's where Bring Back the Trades struggles, because Bring Back the Trades, yes, we have a board and everything, but we have to be able to get to the next level because nobody's a paid employee. For Bring Back the Trades to really be Bring Back the Trades, it needs to be an actual paid, people need to be paid to do things. We're getting there. That's, you know, I mean, my ultimate goal, and I'm telling everybody right now, my ultimate goal is to be a paid person. Not to be like paid, but so that I can go out and do what I want to do. Like I said, I'm not a millionaire. I need to make money to pay my bills.
Right.
You know, if I can't do Bring Back the Trades and make it successful so that we can help more kids and do Turn Spoiler at the same time.
Right.
It's, you know, this summer it's been hard. I've had to not get in trouble, but, you know, push some jobs aside to do Bring Back the Trades to make this my grow event. So it's hard. Go ahead.
So I guess my question
is, I don't know the answer.
But it's going to be, and rightfully so, it's going to be a win-win because you're going to provide.
Probably when Milwaukee said yes to us, probably was when I really thought, like, holy crap.
Because I think that you get tapped into something like that, I think that that does take you to the next level and gives you the exposure.
It does, but the problem is, you know, they're asking us, you know, where's your team? And everybody's a volunteer team. So that's the hardest part that I see, because I'm not corporate. In order to do what I want to do, it has to be somewhere corporate, because you have to make it more presentable. Like, the website's going to be great, but it'll never be what I want it to be to help more kids staying grassroots. It has to be big. But I'm a stickler about people doing their work. I've had a couple people work for me that, you know, they think they know what they're doing, and, you know, it's because I'm a firm believer. What has brought Bring Back the Trades successful is every single sponsor has either I've been in their office or they've been in my office. I don't do emails. I will, but I want to come here. I want to. I mean, David Greer, owner of Wild Belt. Well, he still is, but he's retired. He's given me thousands of dollars, all from coffee in my shop. I'm the firm believer. Come to my shop, have coffee, and talk to me.
Well, that's the one thing when I asked you and you said, no, I'm coming up.
Yep.
That, Jeff, like, that is so cool.
Oh.
So cool. So what I want to say then, too, is this. I want to find out, what would your advice be? Because I've got a younger daughter.
Yep.
A young daughter. She's in probably 21, 22. A lot of that group is still trying to find their way. Mm-hmm. Bree fortunately found her way.
Mm-hmm.
What would be some of your advice to someone new coming in? I know we talked about a little bit. It's like, hey, if someone can handle the outside, let's look at construction, plumbing, because cold doesn't impact that.
Yep.
If it's this, maybe manufacturing. What would be some of your advice to somebody that, if they came and said, 4 years is not for me?
Oh, yeah. Well, the question I always ask, what interests you?
Yep.
You draw? I'm sorry, what's your name again?
Jeff.
What does Jeff do? I mean, this is what you do. So that would be, you know, machinist, or, you know, something to do with AV.
Yeah.
I want to find out what they do, because if you don't find out what they like to do, you're never going to find out what their interest is.
Yeah.
So what does she like to do?
Yeah. So find a passion. Find, what do you do? Good answer.
I mean, if you don't find that, you can't just throw darts at the wall.
Yeah.
And you don't want to waste their time, because the trouble I find out is if you put the kid down the wrong path, like college. I mean, I hate to say it, but how many kids go to college? They think they want to do this and they drop out. Yeah. I've got family members that, you know, they went to college for 2 years thinking they were going to do this, and it's not like they decided that's not what they want to do.
Right.
So that's why I also say ride along. I call it a ride along. Like, I had a kid that wanted to do construction. I'm like, okay, one of my board members, he owns a construction company. I said, go to the job site, because he does electrical, he does landscaping, he does plumbing, he does roofing, he does all, you're going to be able to see all of it. You wouldn't believe how many kids that become, that want to become plumbers, that all of a sudden decide they want to be a mason. They went there, oh, I like that. So you don't, the ride along, they can see what they want before they pick it.
Yeah.
That's what I want
to
say.
That's a great concept.
It's like
too.
TV. Yeah. I mean, you watch the trailer of the movie before you go to the movie. You want to see what it's about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes the trailer turns out to be better than the actual movie.
That's what I'm saying. You got to see, you know, it's yeah. like everything. I mean, like with Bring Back the Trades, I have learned so much. I mean, it's, and that's why when I get up there and do the talks, it's like, you know, I like the back and forth, because kids, you know, if somebody says, hey, come do a speech in front of kids. Well, are they trades kids? Yeah. They're not going to want to listen to me do a speech, because they're going to be up there like I was in an auditorium fidgeting. Let's do a one-on-one, or let's get them involved. My best success story was, we went to, you probably know, but I can't remember. What's the name of the school that's on the back gate of Pease?
It's Great Bay?
Nope. It's for high school kids that have, you know.
You God.
Know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I do.
It's for kids that are having issues. Can't remember that. Okay, anyways. So they call me up and they say, can you come over and do one of your little mini events in our gym? I said, absolutely. I love kids like that. She's like, principal comes over and she says,
it's not New Heights, is it?
It was New Heights, but it's a different school now.
Yeah.
She goes, this is going to be a tough crew. I said, great, bring them on. She goes, there's going to be a lot of kids.
Another challenge for Steve Turner, right?
Well, I know how to reach them. So all of my vendors, I brought my sewing machine over there. I made up all these things so the kids could actually use a screw gun, this and that. She goes, this is going to be a tough crowd. I get done. I've got pictures. I had this one girl. They said she was going to be trouble. She was unbelievable. I said, you want to sew? I said, she goes, oh, yeah. Make a long story short, I walk out there. She's like, what'd you do? I said, I gave them self-worth. Said, what do you mean? I said, I gave them something to inspire them. These kids, they don't have good family lives. It's always, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. You got to make them feel good about themselves. Yeah. Everybody wants to feel good about what they do.
Absolutely.
And if these kids are, they're in a vicious circle. Yeah. They have no home life. They're in foster care. They're like, I'm useless. You put them on a job site. I mean, I like this said, this one girl, I like to find out where she is. She was, can I please do that? She was asking, please.
Please.
Probably never does that. She's like, oh my God, this and that. I mean, it was, that's where I get the drive from, because it's like, if you can just change one student at a time.
Yeah.
Self-worth. I always use that self. Everybody wants to feel like they're worth something.
Right. That's awesome. So now we're going to jump back to your business for a second.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just going to be, I'm going to digress for a minute here, because I am a huge Wheeler Dealer.
Really?
Junkie when it comes on. Meaning I like to watch.
Oh, yeah.
So my
is that show still on?
Yeah. And he's,
what channel?
It's on Speed.
Okay. I don't think I have that channel.
Yeah,
okay.
It's on Speed.
I love, which mechanic are they on now, though?
Elvis is his name.
Okay.
Elvis is his name.
I love that show.
Yeah. So the one thing I've always noticed, and I wanted to ask you, because you look at this stuff.
Yep.
They do everything in-house except for one thing.
The interior. I thought they, you sure, the first guy used to do his own interiors.
You talking about Ed China?
Yes.
Not anymore, because you got away, you got that, whether it's an Australian guy, whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
He didn't do anything. And now this guy, Elvis, mechanic, phenomenal.
Yep.
Doesn't touch interiors.
Okay.
Doesn't touch interiors. So we wanted to ask, I this is a question from mine that I had to, without, what were some of the coolest cars you've worked on without divulging, obviously, any, what were some of the better cars that you've, or?
That's a hard question.
sorry, man.
Done so many. I mean, we have one customer that we do. You've probably seen the Shelbys.
Yeah.
He does. We do probably, I've probably done 75 Shelbys for him, and they're the real deals. They all
they're not the kit cars or anything.
No, they're the real million-dollar ones. They all go to the Seagram's, Mustang Museum in California. They all go there. So they come to my place. The car will cut, and it's funny because they do them like exactly the way they're done. And if the interior is brand new, we still redo it. Every single thing on the car gets redone. I mean, it's insane. I did do a famous car. I can't say it right here, but I did a famous guy's car last year. I've done a couple of Bugattis. We just did a 55 Corvette. That probably came out, I don't know if it was the color of the interior, but it probably came out one of the best interiors I think I've ever seen. And I'm picky.
Yeah.
But you know what? Everybody asks me, and I'll say this, this is true. I don't own a car, and I've never owned a car. And everybody's like, you don't? I love what I do, but I'm not a car guy. Yeah. It's funny because I watched Dana Patrick. Yeah. She's not she drives a car. She doesn't work on a car. She knows nothing about engines. And I'm like, wow. So there's somebody else out there that really, she loves to drive, but she's like, I'm not a car girl. I just love to drive.
That's funny.
I'm not a car guy. Yeah. I love cars, but I'm not a car guy.
That's awesome.
I'm an artist that paints that doesn't put anything up on the wall.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Oh, man. Do you have any questions? I don't want to leave you out, Jeff.
No, I was looking through my notes just a bit ago, and it looks like we covered anything. Except for your events. Yep. I used to, at my previous job, I ended up running our events, and I just remember how hard it was kind of like having like that activity to get people engaged and actually like staying at your booth. So I don't know if you have any tricks or anything, since you've been doing a lot of them now.
So I make sure everything, I mean, some vendors, they like Granite State Manufacturing, their submarines, like the shipyard, they can't really show a lot of their stuff because it's all top secret.
Right.
And then Wirebelt, which is, they do a lot of, they do all the what do you call them? The mesh conveyor belts for like Lindt chocolate and all that. So a lot of stuff they have is, they don't want to show, so it's top secret. So they can't like show a lot, but I make sure the vendors, like the plumbers, electricians, the welders will be sitting there showing the kids. Sometimes if the kid is taking welding, we'll let them weld with them as long as our insurance covered. But I want to make sure that it's as much hands-on as possible to show what's there, because I don't want it to be just a pilot. Because kids aren't going to, they're going to throw them away.
Yeah.
Plumbing. We'll have them sweaty pipes.
That's cool.
And stuff like that. Because a lot of kids, believe it or not, they don't know. And plus, there's so many new tools out there, like Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is so many. It's almost like if you talk to an old timer, they're like, they don't even know how to sweat a pipe anymore because it's all press and fit.
I've seen that at my mother-in-law's house. Yeah. Everything.
But they say, and I've used the tool myself, that once it's done, I mean, everything must fail, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't fail as much.
Yeah.
The tool does it, and you don't have to worry about putting air through it to make sure that it's not going to leak. But before I forget, I didn't tell anybody how they can apply for a scholarship.
Perfect.
So I always do that, but it should have done it at the beginning. So go to bringbackthetrades.org, go to the scholarship page. We do pay, you know, I want parents to know that we pay the school directly. The kid doesn't win the $1,500. You just have to be enrolled in a trade school or a four-year college. And we do give them out to any age. We do want to give them out to kids that are going into the trade school, but we have given them out to, I think, two or three adults. Because if the story is good enough, everybody's story is good, believe me, but if it's good enough, I will give it out to them. So we're trying to do that. But the biggest thing is we need to raise more money, because my feeling is, I'm not saying that every kid is going to drop off if they don't get financing, but there could be some kids out of the 300 a month, there could be 10 or 20 kids that decide they can't afford it and they drop out without our money.
Yeah.
So that's the part that kind of scares me.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts?
Thank you very much for having me and finally meeting you.
Dude, this has been great. This has been great.
And I just want to say, you know, like, anybody can do what I've done if you put your mind, seriously, if you put your, like, I always use the Tom Brady thing, not everybody can throw a football like him, believe me.
Yeah.
But it's the work ethic that got him there. you know?
Yeah, it's work ethic, but it's also awareness, and I think that also, too, opportunity rewards people that are prepared.
Yeah.
I honestly believe that. I do, because, you know, I look at my situation, it's like if I chose that path, and again, my support system was in place.
Yep.
From my wife to my kids.
Yep. And I have the same system too. I want to talk about my son too before I forget.
Yes, Riley. Okay. Yep.
So Riley went to a 4-year college, got his master's. He's killing it. He's working for Bottom Line Technologies. Yeah. But, and Riley, you know, came to me one day and he's like, "Dad, I don't want to do what you want to do." And I'm a firm believer. I'm like, I don't. And that's a sad thing because my wife's like really upset because if the business closes without me, we get, you know, we built the business because everybody builds a business to financially make money off of it.
Absolutely.
But I've already come to grips that, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So he came to me, he's like, "Dad, I don't really want to do this." I said, "I don't care, but I want a plan. This is a lot of money. And I'm out here pushing bring back the trades. So do it." So he's like me. He has a plan, gets his master's. He's killing it. But go back to high school. He was taking marketing. He made my first brochure for Bring Back the Trades. He's at every event. He did drone stuff. So he's involved with the Micro event. He just did up. It'll be coming out soon. I've always wanted a jingle. And my son, like, has always been, like, my number one supporter. I come home yesterday, and he goes, "Hey, I wrote you a jingle." I'm like, "Why'd you write me a jingle? You're in marketing." He played it back, and I'm like, "How long did it take you?" He goes, "I've been studying you." And I'm like, "You wait till you hear this. We're trying to put it to music. It's incredible."
Perfect.
So what I'm saying is, without, like, Riley, my wife, my mother, 85, she's at all my events. I mean, it's, like you said, without this support system, you can only, you know, I talk about Tom Brady with the Edelman catch.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole... He threw it. Yeah. Wasn't a really good pass, but still. What I'm saying is, you can only be as good as your receiver.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my wife is my receiver. My son is my receiver.
Yeah.
You're my receiver.
Yeah.
You're giving me a platform to talk more.
I'm going to want you back again.
Yeah. Definitely.
Perfect.
Maybe we'll get Mike Rose sitting next to us.
There you go. I don't know if I got that kind of dough.
No, I'm talking. He owes me and he comes back.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. This has been a complete pleasure. This is exactly what I want this to hear from. So people doing great things, which is what you're doing, helping that next generation.
If we can get one kid to listen to this that's having a bad day, to listen to this and say, you know what? It is possible. That's all that matters. Yeah.
I know my daughter and my kids will be pushing, my son will be pushing this out to a generation that are the target audience.
Yeah.
So...
And if we can just change the stigma so that, you know, the kids that are financially making the money, when the plumber or electrician comes in their house, they give a little bit more of a respect to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. Perfect. Well, Steve, it's been enough. Thank you. Thank you. All right. So this concludes episode 2. It's been an absolute honor to have Steve here with us. Just an amazing guy. That's all I'm going to say. We'd like to take this time to thank our sponsors. Tasker Funeral Home, located at 621 Central Ave in Dover. Phone number is 603-742-4961. As well as Grondin Funeral Home, 177 North Main Street in Rochester, 603-332-1563. And last but not least, McIntyre McCooey Funeral Home at 301 Main Street, South Berwick, Maine, 207-384-2373.